I want to give a context to what we're doing here tonight. I'm going to read you a letter that I received before a convention on bullying from a child that was bullied. Dear Mr. Rothschild, when I heard about the theme of your convention, I did not want to miss this opportunity to relate a crucial message, a message coming from the depth of my being. Learning in school comes easy to me, yet I am extremely clumsy and incapable on the ball field and at the playground. Since I was 7, I was teased and tormented, targeted, bullied, blamed and shamed and excluded. During my elementary school years, I led a lonely existence. My parents, both mechanchim of stature, knew that I was being tortured every day. They did what they could. They spoke to the menal, the rebbeim, year after year, changed my classes, even changed my glasses. The rabbeim always punished the perpetrators, which you can only imagine made my existence that much more intolerable. There was no hope for me. Once I wasn't one of them, I would never be one of them. No matter where a kid lives, Lakewood, Muncie, Brooklyn, or beyond, kids rule. A kid's world is ruled by his peers. You are in or you are out. Hurtful words are just the beginning of destroying a kid's character and sense of self. In a kid's world, hurt escalates as rapidly as wildfire. I was still excelling in my learning only because it was so easy for me. However, I became morose to the point of not functioning. Then I was done. One day, I just got on a bus and left. Where and what? The details are unimportant. I only want to relate to you the story of how one day a ray of warmth came into my life. I was very hungry. It had been a long time since I had a real meal. I subsisted on very little. I went into a small kosher grocery store with very little money. I was checking out when I realized I didn't have enough money to pay. At exactly that moment, the cashier stepped away from the register to get some more bags. I quickly grabbed the food and ran out of the store. My legs, however, became leaden. I knew in my mind that I needed to run and run fast, but somehow my legs did not connect with that message. I ducked behind the dumpster, my heart pounding, waiting for a yelling, screaming manager to follow me and call the police. But it was quiet. 10 minutes later, I started across the street, noticing the lady who was standing behind me with a full shopping cart, piling her purchases into her trunk. I knew she had witnessed the entire scene. Till this day, I don't know what possessed me, but I approached her and asked her, how was it that there was no commotion when I ran out with the stolen goods? She looked me straight in the eye and said not to worry about it. She paid my bill. No one was going to call the police. I was safe. Just go home, she said. I stood there flabbergasted. Why should you pay? Why would she pay for me, especially when I ran away with stolen goods? Her answer was simple and smothered me with warmth and sadness. You looked so hungry, she said. That one loving sentence was the beginning of my road back to life. I wish I could be there, esteemed Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbonim, Rabbeim, teachers, countless Asgonim, to speak to you personally. I have just one message to relate. You, the chosen members of Klal Yisrael, chosen to be the mechanchim of a tortured, confused generation, you have the ability to encourage your students. Just put your arm out. There are tens of thousands of us waiting to grab hold. Sincerely, on the road home. This was a letter that I received and I read to this convention that we did in 2012, and there was not one dry eye in the place. This is just one child, but there are many more like him. And even if they don't go off the derech, the collateral damage of bullying is absolutely epic. It ruins people's lives. It shatters self-confidence and everything that comes after that. And so with Hashem's help, we have two experts here who are going to help us to be able to give us the wisdom to help us be able to solve or move in the right direction on dealing with this complicated topic. So we're going to start with the first question, which is, what is the difference, if there is one, between students just being not nice and bullying? Dr. Shapiro.
I'm still internalizing the story.
The story is amazing.
It's really
mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think by default, when children are not provided with a certain structure or guidance, they're going to default to negative behavior. So the question really is, how is it in our yeshiva system that we see negative behavior in this manner? And I think we need to define that there are two pieces to what we see as negative behavior within students and amongst peers. The example I like to give is if one boy pushes another boy off of a swing. So we're very quick to say, oh, it's bullying. It's not always bullying. There are two possibilities. One is that it's bullying, and the other possibility is that it's a maladaptive social behavior. And the approach has to be very different in addressing it. So if the boy pushes the boy off the swing because he wants the swing, that's what we would call maladaptive social behavior, and the approach to dealing with that is educating, turn-taking, perspective-taking, giving the opportunity to use language instead of physical, that I want the swing. The alternative is if he pushes the boy off the swing because he wants to push the boy off the swing. That intentional, the abuse of power with the intent to harm others, that's the operationally defined definition of what bullying is. It's the abuse of power with the intent to harm others. So that's bullying. And then the approach becomes very different. How we handle that is both understanding the bully, which is a very complex personality, understanding victimization, and what we see traditionally in classrooms, you know, you'll often have one or two chronic bullies in a grouping, one or two chronic victims,
right,
and then the vast majority of the class are what we call bystanders.
Right.
And so finding that balance. So the first thing we need to define is the event or is what's happening and is, as a recurring event, is it maladaptive social behavior where we need to educate the class on appropriate
right.
interactions, or is it bullying? So once we have defined it,
that
then the approach
is, we can,
is different right. as well.
Great, thank you. That was very, very helpful. So now I want to come to, I want to read you a note that, and this is something that came from a few different people. Often I encounter the victim being the bully or the other way around. Sometimes parents call in to complain about a student bullying their child. How do I know who's the victim and who's the bully? This came from from a different teacher, but this I just like the way they said this. The same boy comes to me almost daily with stories about how kids, sometimes in his class and sometimes from grades above, bothered him. I'm not always able to look into it, but when I do, the other kid in question invariably denies that it happened or it happened that way. I don't think I could sit as a judge or detective and proclaim one right and the other wrong. And so the question to you, Mordechai, is, it's very difficult to be able to know what's going on. How can we expect a teacher to be able to figure it out? And do you have an advice for teachers? Now we're talking about, this is to teachers. What would you think is some kind of wisdom that they could try to sort it out?
I would probably take a different question first. And the first question is sort of what you're saying, Rabbi Rothschild. What is the role of a teacher? What can a teacher do? So
okay.
as we have, Dr. Shapiro's mentioning that a lot happens during the off time. But let's just realize what's happening. As a parent, if you've got two kids fighting, if you take any one of their sides, you immediately lost. You're guaranteed both to say, so let's say one kid hit the other or grabbed away the toy. You go, how could you grab? And you yell at the one that grabbed away. He goes, but yesterday the other one grabbed it first. So they're just playing each other back. Which is once again what Dr. Shapiro was saying, that very much about relationships and about dealing with what's happening in school. It's not about right now. There could be just old stuff going on. So when you're going to speak to the quote-unquote bully, you'll find out that maybe last year this kid bullied him and now is just paying back a year later.
Okay.
So the first step for as a teacher, so how do we deal with this? Is
right.
number one, we got to look at it as a holistic approach. One step is we've got to speak, there's really several components, but number one is speak to the kid that is actually bullying, not attacking, just asking. So step one, so we got to look at it as three prongs all at the same time. Number one, kid, what's going on? What happened? Without attacking. Let's get the full story.
Okay.
Step two, speak to the kid that's the victim. What's the whole story? When did this start? You want to understand the story. Now right. We've got two opposite stories where both are going to be the victims here.
Right.
Now comes step three, actually teaching the skills and all that we're going to get into as the questions go, how to start integrating these two. How to start teaching, let's say, the victim, and there are some phenomenal little steps that I'd like to do with you, like even a role play, and I'm even going to ask, I'm going to be the bully.
Right.
And then we'll switch roles, which actually very simple skills that a teacher can practice with each. So both with the bully, how to ask, how to say something, and especially the victim, that many times you want to defend yourself, you're actually putting gasoline on a fire. But if you can just like, just look the person in the eye, make a joke, or there's a lot more how to switch the whole view.
Right.
Everything changes, and that happens all the time.
You know, I love what you're saying, and I never thought about it in terms of addressing bullying, but there's a whole approach in educational leadership called inquiry-based practice versus problem-solving practice. And oftentimes our default, at least men anyway, we like to problem solve.
Right.
So we go into this problem solving mode. And problem solving mode is address the bully and punish the bully. Or address the victim and just tell them to, you know, don't react or how we want to solve problems. But a much more effective approach, and again, I never thought about putting it in the bullying, is an inquiry-based approach. It's really soliciting information, gathering the information from all parties. Just that process of listening, and as a therapist, you know this, the process of listening often resolves many issues. And it also allows you to, when people sense that you're really inquiring, they open up a lot more, their defenses come down, and the communication can really begin at that point. So that's a great point about applying it to bullying
situations. So I would like to share one example, and you'll watch how a completely different area issue has caused bullying. So I was involved in a case where there was about a 12-year-old boy bullying another kid in the class, but really attacking him, bumping into him in the hallways, not letting him play any of the sports, and the kid is crying. And I was speaking to that teacher, to the Rebbe, actually, and I was just going to the Rebbe, could you just speak to the quote-unquote bully and ask him what's going on? That's it. Don't even ask about bullying yet. And the first thing that this kid was saying, oh, you have no idea. And he says, I'm really angry at you, Rebbe. He says, why? He says, you remember two, three months ago, I didn't do well, a couple of weeks on the marks, and you called up my father. And since then, my father's really, really upset at me. He goes, wow, and that really bothers you. He says, I'm so sorry I did that. And then as he's hearing and just all this stuff going on, he says, and tell me, what's going on with this kid? I noticed things are going on. He says, yeah, he's the smartest kid in the class. I'm upset, I'm jealous that you called his father, he's doing well, and since you called my father, I'm getting hit and I'm getting yelled at. Yeah. And he's asking me all the time, how am I doing in school? So this kid, not realizing by being smart, is victimizing the bully, that he's feeling I could never be like that, and now this bully is attacking him just to defend his own mind. So just for teachers and Rebbeim to realize, we don't realize what most bullies, when you're speaking to them, actually feel the victim, and they don't have the skills and the knowledge and the tools. Now, I'm not defending bullying and their behaviors, but once we understand the psyche, what they're going through, but just by asking, and realizing it, now we can create an intervention. So let's not jump into punishment, yelling, screaming. You do have to create safety. But just a story like that, if we understand what's going on, we can change the concept. So step one is just ask, speak to each kid. What's going on? Was there any history?
Great. Okay.
I think one of the challenges for teachers are they often feel that their mandate is to educate and to teach. And the behavioral components often interfere with that. And so the goal for in problem solving isn't just to problem solve for the sake of problem solving, it's to problem solve so I can get back to my primary function, which is educating.
Right.
And I think that inquiry-based process, it's not a natural process because you're really focused on your goal, which is teaching.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that teachers aren't concerned about their students' emotional well-being and
right,
social well-being,
right.
But really there's that pressure to teach curriculum, hit a certain point, and there often isn't time built in
to
for this,
able
and
to,
so that
right.
pressure is there, and let's just problem solve and let's move on.
Right. And probably they don't even have so much opportunity to talk one-on-one with children also. So
I will say, though, in general, within the field of education, what I've seen over the last 20 years is there has been a strong shift towards the affective domain of education, which is that understanding that the emotional experience of a child is so critical within the context of the school experience.
Sure.
And both their social success and their academic success really relate back to that. So I have seen a strong, when I was growing up in yeshiva, there were no school social workers, you know, they just didn't exist.
Right.
Today, there I think there's a much stronger understanding.
Right. So let's get into specific questions now. One girl tells the class not to befriend a certain girl. What should I do as a teacher? Now, we know that exclusion is a form of bullying. So, Dr. Shapiro, what would you say?
It's a real challenge because, you know, children in general want a sense of autonomy. So if you're going to come in and say, no, everyone has to be friends with this girl, they're going to push back. And then Then it becomes even more subtle that way. It's like, well, I, you know, invited her to participate, but there's so much of that paraverbal communication, the physical piece. So I can say the words, oh, do you want to play with us? But it could be like,
Right.
Do you want to play with us? You know,
right.
And so I...
So they know that you don't, that they're not welcome.
Yeah, so I think the challenge is really shifting kids into a modality of behavior where they are enacting what it is that you want without the sense that you are making them do that. So one of the strategies, and I think it also goes back to this inquiry process instead of problem solving, is creating, it reminds me of this story. I was once challenged to run bully prevention programming, but I wasn't allowed to use the word bully, which is quite a challenge. So how do you address that? And so I created something called the Kindness Club. And the Kindness Club, what it did was we identified targeted behaviors that we want to see students engaging in with one another. And it was very general, like I hold the door open for someone. If I see someone drop something, I pick up their pencil.
Right.
Or I help someone carry their books. Now, if we can focus on promoting positive behavior in general, and there are whole systems, systemic approaches to promoting positive behavior within a classroom or within a school environment, then all of a sudden kids are going to be much more inclusive and kids are going to bring other people on board and engage in acts of kindness without having to specify you have to include this girl. You're really addressing the overall culture of a classroom as opposed to targeting a specific child and that is excluding and a specific child that is including. And I think it's critical to address the overall culture within a classroom
right.
as well as within the school as well.
Right. So I want to tell you that at Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation, we actually have numerous curriculums and programs that do that, and it's called actually Creating the Caring Classroom. But having said that, there are some people who are really mean and really want power. And says, like, I'm excluding that girl because first of all, just by excluding somebody, that gives me power. What would you say?
So if we look at children or even teenagers as adults in training, that means we need to teach them every step of that stage of growth. So teenagers, we've got to teach them, let's say, Bachrim, that they're going to have a Rebbe from every minute in class, them being in Beis Medrash, and how they'll be in Beis Medrash and learn even when they don't have the Rebbe on top of them. Part of the concept that I hear a lot that parents go parents say is, the kids are fighting, they'll figure it out on their own. They're not supposed to figure it out on their own. We're supposed to teach it to them several times, and then they will continue that positive behavior. So that's how we learn how to tie our shoes. That's how we, as a frum yid, we can go with the yarmulke. And we're not struggling with that when other people, when they become frum or they start doing that, they find it a challenge. Let's take that now to class participation. If a teacher, day one, week one of school, is focusing, this is how my class is run. Everyone must participate in the class sport, whatever it should be, at recess, and I am going to be supervising it and making sure that everyone is there. This is a rule. This is how it goes. And the teacher's actually active and starts setting up a program, which is, okay, every week we'll have three girls that are in charge of choosing the game. And you, part of the role is, does every kid play? And what happens, part of the discussion is going to be, what happens when some kids are not good at this sport? And this teaches children how to interact. Now, once you've got a week or 2 to 3 weeks, it's usually about 3 weeks, with a teacher's intervention, active participating, which takes time, do you know what happens after that? It gets so much easier. So much easier.
Sure, because they're already on the roll.
They're on the roll. But if you don't deal with it the first 3 weeks, the teacher's actually going to be suffering for the entire year.
Right.
And the teachers are great teachers. Principals are phenomenal. They're in to help. And I just want to tell everyone, both principals, teachers, Rebbeim and Mechanchim, and as well as social workers, we're at the bottom rung of payroll. So we're not doing it because we're looking to make the big bucks. We're doing it because we're here to help Yiddish kids and literally create and develop Chayil Jewish soldiers.
Right.
So you're in it, and if you can realize that by investing 3 weeks in the class and making sure things are happening, things will change. I'd like to share with you one story. The story is an interesting story, and I actually interviewed that Rebbe because I couldn't believe what he did. I had a certain relative that was sick from, let's say, fourth grade, at least 3 weeks out, always with strep in different areas. So 3 weeks out of the year was always missing. That's a lot. Fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, didn't miss one day. And there was such a change in this relative that I asked the Rebbe, what do you do? One of the behaviors that he did is he says, throughout the day, I make sure to reach every kid just for a minute and go, how are you doing today? How did you sleep? How did you eat? Just simple questions. And the minute the kid felt that little bit of attention, each kid, and we're talking about maybe 30 seconds.
Right.
He said every single kid, almost, I said 90% of the week there was nothing. But there was always that one kid that goes, like what happened? This worried about the test, something going on in class, something with a friend. That little bit, and once he found out what that was, he was able to do a little intervention. Mm-hmm. It's once a day. It could be 20 kids. It's just, hi, how are you today? Is everything okay? That simple question. And kids, you can really read their body language.
For sure.
And that's all it took. That this kid, since then, has never had strep or missed, quote unquote, school for stomach aches and for headaches. So again, the power of teachers, rebbeim, and principals. Just connecting with a kid and doing your little behavioral intervention, creating that changes.
I think you're saying two great ideas. Really, one is that the structure of the classroom really requires addressing every behavior that we want to see in the classroom. So even creating the structure within the recess and within the social interactions amongst the students, that structure needs to be transparent and communicated in order for the kids to internalize it and reinforced. And I think that's, you know, sometimes we, if we have the rules on the board, on the wall, but we never address it and they just sit there all year gathering dust, then we haven't really done our job as educators. It really requires that conversation. And the other piece is, you know, there's an idea, there's a strategy within schools called conscious discipline. And one of the major points of that is something called a connection before correction. And that idea is the relationship has to be there. You have to communicate, to connect with the students, get to know them, let them feel that there's a real connection, and then those corrections and the behaviors will change and the engagement will change and the overall paradigm of what school is and what that school experience is will change as well, to the point where even physical, to that degree, which is amazing, the even physical experiences and illness will be diminished as well. That's fascinating.
Thank you.
But I just want to say one other thing, why I think it's such a great idea, because the problem with bullying is that they always, like some of the questions that I read here was that there's one child or two children that always choose, if it has to be that every single person gets to choose, then you've robbed the power from that person to always be the chooser. No, they can't. In other words, and again, the teacher has to be involved in that.
I think an important thing that was mentioned was that giving students language on what to do when the rules aren't being followed. So like we said, if there's one or two bullies in a class, or one or two victims in a class, and the majority of the class is really bystanders, they can only be positive bystanders and effective bystanders if they're given the tools to say something. So if someone's being excluded as a group, we say, no, that's not what our class does. You know, rule number seven, like we as a class include everyone. That's our mandate as students. And if it's reinforced, it robs the bully of the power because the majority has spoken.
So let me ask you a question, and that is, most people are intimidated and they don't have the power. So if I was your student and you were the teacher, what would you tell me to do?
So it's interesting, the number one reason why bystanders don't respond and react And they've surveyed tens of thousands of bystanders.
Right.
They don't want to be the next victim. So there's a fear of, like, if I stand
out
there.
Yeah, okay.
But
that's a good reason.
Yeah, no, but if, as you said, that the culture is created by the teacher, where the bystanders are empowered,
and that they have the what are you going to tell
by giving them language, by reinforcing the concepts, by saying this is a class where everyone's included, and it gets reinforced,
this
and as a
class.
Group I've seen it as an effective
let me take exactly what Dr. Shapiro is saying and ground it, because really what he's saying is, imagine the teacher at the end of the day would speak to three or four kids and just ask, hey, was everyone included?
And?
What's going on? You're actually following up on what is happening. You're following up. The kids will tell you, did everyone play? Imagine part of the teacher's role is saying, okay, at the end of the day, I'm going to ask, did every single kid participate? Who didn't? And then they go, oh no, these three kids didn't play because they didn't want to.
Right.
And then the next thing that the teacher will do is, not during class, after class, approach those three kids and say, hey, why didn't you play?
Right.
So you're actually including them. Oh, we don't think we were really wanted. We don't think maybe that we're not good at that sport. They really don't want us to play. Or last time they made fun of us for whatever reason.
Once, I don't really hear. I'm like.
Sorry. I like that you're challenging. Which part?
Yeah, you don't really hear how. I hear what you're saying, what you're both saying, but I still
you're
don't
intervening.
Get. One, no, I know you're intervening, but I still don't get if I'm the bystander, and I'm scared.
Oh, I wasn't talking about the bystander.
Right, I know, but you're talking about now, like, to ask them a question and see if they were included. But how do you, what do you teach the bystander that he should have the gvura to stand up when the bully is going to do something wrong?
Bystanders won't stand up as individuals.
That's right.
That's too difficult. Exactly what you're saying. But as a group, bystanders. So let's just say, they go out to the playground, and one boy brings the football, and he's like, okay, you can play, you can't play. And all of a sudden, the culture has been determined by the teacher. We've talked about this in the past, that everyone gets included. And the group, not one individual, the group says, if everyone doesn't play, we don't play. Then that reduces the power of the bully, and then it becomes inclusive.
So, okay, great. That's a great, brilliant.
So right.
In other words, you're saying it's the power of the group.
It's
not, you don't have to be the individual.
Correct.
It's like, we don't do that here. I think we once had a program like that. We don't do that here yet.
But it has to be established by the teacher.
Exactly.
The group empowerment and the follow-up.
So I was writing four points. Imagine the teacher starts day one in the class, besides just saying the rules about being on time, doing homework, you're going to have tests every week, you got to know what to do. There's now, let's talk about the class or recess behavior. Number one, everyone's got to play. Number two, the goal of everyone playing is to enjoy. Winning is secondary. I want to hear everyone is enjoying. Number three, everyone must play, even if you're not good at that sport. You must play. You must participate. Number four, I am going to follow up after that. Part of my role is everyone involved? And if not, we'll discuss later why not. So this is a three-week process of getting the class in the focus of participating. It doesn't happen in day one.
Right.
But as that happens, as the teacher follows up, as the kid actually feels, wow, I'm invited, I'm there, I can be part of it. I was a division head in a big camp, so I must have had about 200 kids just under me. And what we realized is that there were probably 20 kids from that whole division that did not like sports. They just don't like sports. Now, what are they going to do? So they're playing around on the side, they're not there, we got to leave, we got to find them, they're all over. And we actually said, okay, you 20 guys, what do you like? We got them involved in what they like, and whatever that was, it was different points that they liked,
and we
did that. So instead of like, it's got to go a certain way, once the teacher's involved, okay. And remember, the bully might be, they like winning. These kids are like not interested. They're not showing up.
Right.
They're wasting time, and they go, I'm not letting you play. And again, if you speak to the bully, you'll hear that they feel that they're the victim. So the teacher's job is to actually find out what is going on, set the intervention, and then you now come up with a form.
We're talking about this beautiful world where kids understand that winning is not everything, right?
The menu.
People want to win. The kids and adults want to win. That's the bottom line.
The men you're describing didn't grow up with a bully prevention program in their school.
That's what it looks like.
Now, I have a friend who's in business. He's in the insurance business. And he is not in business to win. I mean, he's bankrupt, but no. He's on a visit to win. And he's a friend of mine. I was once, I had insurance from another company, and I said, you know, let me switch over to you. You're a friend. I'll give you the business. He goes, if it's another from guy, I don't want your business.
Okay, that's yeah.
But so obviously he was raised a certain way, and he was inculcated with certain values that it's not about winning. It's about everybody. It's about inclusiveness. And if I take business from that guy, just for the sake of taking business from that guy so I can win, then I'm not doing the right thing. And that's something we should be thinking about when raising children and inculcating these values, that this is not about winning. So it goes back to the structure and the values that we're teaching at a young age. But yes, you're right. We do get adults that are bullies. And we do get
talking about bullies. I'm just talking about adults who want to win. In whatever winning is, a lot of people want to win in this world.
I want you to know something. There's a great organizational leader. I'm not going to mention him by name, but he's a great organizational leader who will never take credit for anything that goes right. He will always say it's a team effort. Always.
Right, right.
And when things go wrong, he takes responsibility for it.
Okay.
So there's a certain way of raising children to have that attitude, that it's not about winning. It's not about being better than the other guy. And maybe it's a lofty ideal, but that's really what we should be shooting for.
Right, I hear.
So I would like to take another side to this, and which I 100% agree with your side, and I'm that type nature. Sometimes when you're dealing with a class where there is that person, let's say, where it's the family culture to be type A, alpha male, we gotta win, everything's about winning, and if not, do you really take it personal? There are two other interventions that teachers can do to help the victim. The second one we're going to do later on, and that's actually how to respond. But the first one is that the teacher can also help this victim get their own set of friends, which means realize they feel isolated. They feel fooled or foolish. They feel they're stupid. They feel they're a loser. Right. And they feel no one wants to be around them.
Right.
It's further, as we have all the studies showing, it's further reinforced by the fact that why isn't anyone defending me? Do you know why? Because in the victim's mind, what they're hearing is, he's right, or she's right. The class king or queen is right. I'm worthless. That's what goes through their mind. Every time I've recently worked on someone that was bullied for 2 years in sixth and seventh grade, this person's probably 24. I'm just changing the age to keep it private, but that's what happened. It still stayed in his mind he is stupid. He's the smartest in the class in his share. He still goes through his mind, I have bad midos, because that's what the person said. So he's the victim. The bully attacked him, and he's the one walking around that I have bad midos. So what we need to realize is, number one, that when you have an alpha male and the teacher couldn't, let's say, change the structure for whatever reason, could be a whole family. We know that family has problems. All their kids are, I don't like saying that, but sometimes we have that attitude. What the teachers can do, and this is a very simple and easy tool, is the teacher would speak to four boys, let's say, or four girls, whichever it should be in the class.
Right.
See the ones that this kid is close to, and actually tell them, we'd like you to sit with them during lunchtime. We'd like you to play with them, include them. Not one, because remember, just as Dr. Shapiro said, the one kid's afraid of being a victim to the bully. When you have a team of three kids with this kid, team of four, there's now a group, the bully will hesitate to attack, and when there are three, four people together, they usually will speak up. One will say something. So the first step interventions for teachers, Rebbeim, principals, create a structure, create a plan how the class should include everyone. Number two, Individually, it might be hard to get that one individual case. Then you develop a team. You're now getting a support system for this kid, and now they're not alone. And now in their mind is, we have friends. And you also ask those kids to call that kid at night when they go home, just a 3-minute call. Hi, you know, with this homework.
Right.
So what's happening now, the kid is feeling I'm value. And this is all created by the teacher. And to make it clear when you speak to the kids, this friend is not a Rachmanis. You're not doing your chesed.
I was about to.
You're not turning it into a chesed case.
Yeah,
you're turning it into a friendship.
It sounds like chesed.
So it depends how the teacher is doing it. If the teacher is saying, look, I'm realizing that things are happening with this kid, that some kids are picking on them. You're really his good friend. You really like him. I want you to sit next to him. It's not because he's a problem. It's not he's the geek in the class.
Right.
It's you're really good. You like it. He can study. He can help you.
The term that I've used over the years is just supporting the victim. And supporting the victim It's another one of the tools that we want to give kids by educating them. So the same way we educate them with the tool of there's power in the group of bystanders, that's one tool. Another tool is supporting the victim. So when you see and you can't stop the bullying from happening in the moment, there's no group there, you're alone, you can't stand up, you don't want to become the victim, it's okay to go over and say, I saw what happened, that really wasn't nice, and I'm here for you. And that's not really treating someone like a neva.
Next question, Ellie, Dr. Shapiro. Victims of bullying often, not always, come forward, but are easily identified. How do we deal with the bully who is always undercover, never revealing his or her behavior, and crafty enough to bully when no authority member is looking, and who also adamantly denies all wrongdoing?
That's a great question. So there's a few things. The type of bullying you're describing, let's just talk about the different types of bullying. There's overt and covert type bullying. And there actually is more gender types with this than any other aspect. Boys are more likely to do the overt, physical, verbal type bullying. Girls are much better at the covert, subtle, harder to pinpoint type bullying. So we do see that as a gender issue. One of the things that I think is really critical, and we've talked about this before, to this point we've talked about responding and how to create that piece of it. It's more like intervention. But what about the prevention piece? I can tell you, that there's I'll tell the story. There was this one class that I was working with had a significant amount of bullying in their class. And the next year, the Rebbe reported that there was no bullying in the class. And I was like, how do you take a class that goes from one
extreme to another?
And so, as it turns out, most bullying occurs during low supervision times, whether it's boys or girls, whether it's that physical or whether it's that subtle. And if we can identify within a school setting those low supervision times, when is that? That's lunch, it's recess.
The bus
is very hard. That's very complex. But in recess and lunch, the difference between a teacher dismissing their class to recess and the teacher walking their class out to recess and helping them start the game and helping make sure that everyone gets included is the difference between having a class of bullying and a class of not bullying.
And this teacher, you're saying, actually walked out.
This teacher would walk the students out, would give them the language if someone dropped the ball, if someone wasn't included, to give them the language to say, nice try, instead of saying, you messed up, right? Giving them, that's what we're talking about, this educational piece. It reduced the bullying so significantly. And also, when you're to that degree of engagement, you're going to pick up on the subtle, more covert type of bullying.
And when you're there, you'll be able to see it more.
And that's really where we see most of the bullying happening. The bullying is happening during those times, during lunch, during recess, the low supervision times. So the important piece for the teacher is being there, being aware, being engaged, and those nuanced differences, it's a subtle difference. And I know teachers are under pressure. They have to grade papers. They have to, and so it's...
And they want to take a break and drink a coffee, yeah.
Well, coffee's good, too. But that idea of if we really want to address the bullying, there's those pieces of it that is a prevention, you're going to see a significant reduction to the point that this teacher is like, I don't have any bullying in my class. I don't know what you're talking about.
Wow.
So I think that's one way of addressing it. And picking up on going back directly to the question, picking up on the covert type bullying really goes back to that being aware, being present, especially in the low supervision times.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. These are follow-up questions. What do you do if the Rebbe or teacher is identified by the class as the bully? I'm talking more about a few kids describing that type of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Okay. Ouch. Okay. So let's say the teacher is we'll say rough.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do then? Okay.
Let's just say it's a parent asking this question.
Or a school social worker asking, what do you do when there's a teacher or a Rebbe?
It's a little bit rough.
Okay, so you have a student support staff who is asking the teacher or the Rebbe is a little bit rough.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it's within the scope of, you know, really, you feel...
I would like to discuss two points. Maybe we could even do a little bit of a role play of an intervention that teachers and social workers and people can use. Let's start with number one. I have just recently been involved in a case similar to that where someone was claiming that the Rebbe is mean and picking on him. And really, the Rebbe is just animated. And this kid comes from, is a quieter kid. The family is very quiet and edel. And he's having a difficulty adjusting with a high-energy Rebbe. And instead of recognizing it's just a high-energy, low-energy, different personalities, we're now calling that Rebbe a bully. And what has happened was this parent then quietly, in an edel, subtle way, found out if there are other kids that, you know, previous years had a difficulty, and also found three, four other families, and they banded together, and they were sort of saying the Rebbe is terrible. Now, the principal's getting involved in the class, and he's speaking to other parents, and no parents got complaints. Only there are same two, three kids, and what I was able to help the principal identify is this is a difference of natures.
Right.
Meaning, the Rebbe is loud, the Rebbe might even yell, "Hey, what are you doing?" And to this kid in a family with the mother, so little kids, time to go to sleep. And they go, okay, because it has been in the prevention of the family and in the intervention, they're very edel. This kid is feeling bullied by this Rebbe when it's a clash of personalities. So number one, we need to first identify, are there many kids complaining about the same thing, or is it just one or two kids? And then we need to understand what's happening. Is it a difference of natures, or is it a, or is this really something going on? Now,
I love what you did, because what I did, I went right into problem-solving mode, and you went into inquiry mode.
Okay.
Now I'd like to do an interesting skill. This is, I've been holding back, but if we can do a little a role play that I think teachers in Rebbeim might love it. And I'm going to do both roles, both ways. So just to discuss two, three little skills, and I want everyone to recognize the difference. The wrong skill, I don't like saying wrong, but this is the one wrong skill that we all think will help fight a bully. That's fight back. I'm going to first do that role play with you, and I want you to be the bully, and I'm going to fight back, and tell me, after we do this role play, if it made you want to stop bullying me, or if it actually energized you to bully me even more. Even with a parent, if it's a teenager, many times, this is how I help teenagers, when they always complain, my parents don't understand me, my parents are so tough, and they're fighting back, and not only doesn't it help them get what they want, but the parent doubles down saying, my kid is immature. But if we can teach them the skill of literally the opposite, it changes the whole way. So I would like you.
Okay. Okay, you want me to bully you?
Bully me.
Okay, okay, okay. This, by the way, I just want to tell you one thing, is actually difficult, but I'm going to do it anyway. Okay.
Thank you.
Are you crazy? Do you know what you're doing to that person? You're destroying them. Who do you think you are? You're an idiot. You're so stupid.
Oh, yeah?
How can you do that?
Oh, yeah, look at what you're doing. You're doing the same thing. You're even a bigger bully than I am.
I'm not a bigger bully. Are you crazy? I'm not a bigger bully. I'm just defending somebody.
Listen to how you're yelling. You're just as crazy. You're terrible. You got to stop yelling at me. That's what you say I'm doing to him. You're doing it to me.
Okay.
Wait, do you feel it getting better? Do you feel yourself you wanting to stop, or you feel like you want to prove your point? Let's try this now. Do the same thing again. Watch how I'll respond.
Okay, you ready now?
Yes.
It's going to be a little bit easier for me because I'm doing it the second time. Okay, I think. Okay.
Go ahead.
You ready?
Attack.
I cannot believe you. You are such a lowlife. How could you pick on somebody like that? You're so stupid yourself.
Oh my gosh. What did I do exactly?
What did you do? You called him names and you were so disgusting to him, and you would get the lowest grades in the school, and nobody ever likes you, and everybody talks behind your back. They think that you're such a stuck-up idiot.
You're such a nice guy. You really care about what I did to him. Wow.
That's good.
How do you feel? Could you hit? Try to hit back. Continue.
Okay.
What did I do? What's the difference between part one, part two, and teachers, and for or social workers, we want to actually role play the skill. The first skill that I consider, that we call this, is, let's say, absorbing the punch. Don't fight. The more you fight back, the more it's going to give the person the fuel, as Dr. Shapiro is able to watch it escalate. If we can absorb the punch, just take it. And that's where building up, preparing ahead of time, whatever they say, you take it back. You take it. And you just go, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that. So let's say you make fun of someone because they're tall or they're short or their parents are divorced. They would do these bullying. They have red hair. They have black hair. They have blonde hair. Their father's a Rebbe. The father's a millionaire. I've seen everyone get bullied for different things.
Right.
And if watch this. So let's say you bully me because my father's not alive. So in Shemayim. So bully me that my father isn't alive.
I'm going to bully you because you are a spoiled brat.
I love that.
You know that? Your father buys you the most expensive things and you are such a loser. You have nothing except for the money that your fat father has.
So now watch how I'm going to fight back. That's not true. My father doesn't spoil me. Your father spoils me. You're jealous because your father actually doesn't have any money and my father has a fancy car. Okay. What would you do if I do that?
Yeah, I would definitely get angry.
Bingo. So if you fight back...
Well, I don't have to do it again. Just okay, let's fine. Say I say and you're a spoiled brat and your father's rich and that's the only thing you have going for you or nobody likes you.
You know, I love your father. Your father is the coolest father. I sometimes wish my father was like your father.
And?
What happened to your energy? If I do that, you yelled at me. This is the second skill. The second skill is you're actually telling the person, I envy you. Uh-huh. It takes the fight out of the bully. If they go, oh, you're so short, and I wish I was as tall as you if the guy's tall. Or you're tall, you're so tall, and the short person feels inferior because of that. And then you go, I wish I was your height.
You know, the number one thing that makes victims continue to be victims is That's reactivity.
It. Bingo.
All the research indicates that reactivity is the key feature. It's not being tall, it's not being short, it's not being overweight, it's not being underweight. It's not being bad at sports, not
That's
being
right.
good at sports. It's the reactivity because you have multiple short kids in a class or multiple tall kids. So why is it this one kid that is continuously becoming the victim? And it all has to do with the reactivity. And so what Mordechai is showing is that how you react and training yourself to react in a non-reactive way is gonna de-escalate the situation. And the bully is energized and empowered by the reaction. When you do something and something happens, that's empowering. But if nothing happens, it actually reduces the drive of the bully to follow up with at least that individual.
Right. One of the questions, thank you for that. I'm feeling so much better. One of the questions that's come out from a number of different places is that we've been talking about the bully, but then there's a whole list of questions for the victim. And one of the things is that victims, like they to a certain extent, they're just, I don't know, hardwired to be a victim. Like they just look like a victim. And they have such low self-esteem that they wouldn't even be able maybe... They have to have a little bit of zich to be able to...
That's the 101. That's where the teachers get involved. This is a training. When we're discussing now bullying, there isn't a snap your fingers and make three wishes or click your heels and then all of a sudden it's done. It's not how it works.
Right.
How it works is we're giving over here the basis of understanding that the victim's reactivity is what will have a big impact. We want to start giving the teachers or BAME and social workers some knowledge and skills.
Right.
Another one is completely ignore, by the way. Imagine you just tell that to me, that whatever's going on by me, I just stare at you.
Right.
There's usually going to be some deficiency or something to pick on and point out initially.
Right.
But what keeps it being chronic and ongoing is the reactivity. And so if you can train
them not to be
to reduce the reactivity, oftentimes it's very hard because what makes someone a chronic victim is their inability to control the reactions. And so spending time working on that or even projecting, how would someone, even if I don't have the internal strength to not react, if I were someone else, how would I respond? And then act.
Let me ask, I have so many questions here and there's so many coming in, but I'm just going to pick one from one of the new questions, and that is, if you have girls excluding other girls, this is from a second grade teacher, I would encourage a girl who is running after them to join other kinder, more softer girls. Is this the right approach?
Would you like to take it? Sure, absolutely. But I would do it a little differently. Instead of encouraging the girl to join, let's say, a second group, I would be making sure as a teacher, what are the groups? I will make the groups and make sure, so this way she doesn't have to be that extra fourth wheel coming in. It's So how do you do that? You develop actually exercises that should be done, especially girls. Like, you have to call each other up. There's an exercise you have to do at home. A little homework that has to be done at home in a group of three. And every one of the girls love making the phone calls and the whole thing and tying up the phone. Right. And these are the groups.
Right.
You want to bring them in a way that she doesn't feel hurt. There's a second component of here is that if I was a teacher, I would want to break that initial group. How do you break that alpha group?
Right.
You can't break a group. You can't tell people don't hang around. But what you do is you give exercises, homework, but you divide the group. Each of those girls are in a different group. As they start interacting with other girls, that group starts getting diluted.
Right.
And some girls might not want to listen. That group of four just became a group of two. And then there are other girls that join that group of two, and they might be easier and gentler.
Okay, but as a psychologist, I want to ask you a question. What drives kids to want to be friends with that girl or that boy who is mean, popular, mean, and good at sports? Like, what drives them to do, like...
I think kids are attracted to the power of it. So if someone is exuding power, then you want to be in that group. And that, I don't think that's limited to kids. I think it's adults also. Yeah, adults also. When you see power, you want to be part of that. The perception is that that's the in-group. There's also the fear, if I'm not in the in-group, there's two
people. Out-group.
Yeah, so one, you're attracted to the power. Two, if you're not in that group, then you're in the other group. You don't want to be in the other group.
Right.
So I think there's a natural gravitation towards that, unless the empowerment is in the bystanders. And that goes back to what we had mentioned earlier. If we create a power dynamic where the in-group, the group is, the bystanders, which really, by the numbers of it, really is, then that is going to be where people want to be. And people don't want to be with the bully group becomes the out-group.
Right.
Rabbi Rothschild, can we change your question and watch me change the words? Why is it that people are interested in the boy or the girl that's a natural leader, that says things with confidence, that whatever they do, there's life and passion? It's sports, it's learning, it's agreeing with a teacher or disagreeing with a teacher, it's liking what someone has done, it's liking the food, going, this is delicious, or this is horrible. It's their way of speaking, as Dr. Shapiro said, with the energy. We use the terms that they're a bully, that they're this. I really work with many times those kids. I want to shift the energy. If we look at the kid as a natural role leader, and it's like a diamond, we just have to shape the diamond.
So I want to tell you something. You should know that in these questions, that was brought up. Oh, here. How do we help a student with leadership qualities to include all their friends as opposed to bossing them around?
That's right.
So what would you say?
So if I would be the teacher, I first want to go with the cognitive reframe that we're doing it. Let's not look at this girl as a queen bee that's a boss.
Let's look as a leader.
She's someone that wants to win, and she's a leader. And these girls that don't want to play are just doing a favor. They're missing shots. We're losing because they're stuck on my team. So they don't want to play. I don't want them on the game. But I'm being nice to them, and then they're purposely not doing well. And I lost because of them. So don't play. Now watch how a teacher would address it if we look at them that way. Go, you're such a talented girl. You're so good in sports. You're so good in learning and things like that. And isn't it amazing that you let these girls play, but then you lose because of them?
So let's say they don't do that.
They did originally. If you speak to the girl, they didn't allow, like, what do you make the team? And they go, well, watch, if I would ask you, why did you pick these five girls on your team and not the rest of the girls? What would you say?
Because they know how to play. What do you mean? Of course.
Exactly. So you want to win, right?
Of course.
Exactly. Now, imagine there would be another team that they'll be better than you and they won't let you play. What would you do then?
I would make my own team. What do you mean? I don't need them.
But they're going to beat you every time. You're going to lose every time because they're better.
What would I do?
What would you do?
I don't know. Ellie, what would you do?
Well, we're trying to get the queen bee to just open up her mind and to experience what others are feeling.
The perspective taking.
Perspective.
Yeah. Right.
We're going into her world. We're not attacking her. We're trying to teach a second grader. Right? What grade was that? Did they say a grade in that?
This was a second grader.
A second grader. Do you realize that we're calling a second grader a bully already? A tormentor?
Right.
She's dividing the class. Second grader is what? 8 years old? 7 years old?
Yeah.
I mean, imagine we just help realize, and more than that, tell her, like, imagine those girls are so upset at you when you're so nice. Because did you ever let them play? Yes, and we lost. They didn't do their best. Right, so you're nice, and everyone's upset at you. How can we change it? Like, could we maybe make the teams that every team is going to have three good girls and three not such good girls? So this way it's going to be balanced that sometimes you'll lose points and they'll lose points.
Right.
But we're working with them to include everyone. Uh-huh. And we're not looking at an 8-year-old as a bully.
Right.
Poor 8-year-old. I mean, they're still coming into mommy's and tati's beds when they have a nightmare.
Right.
You know, there we need to just
no. But you said
them.
A very interesting thing. If you figure out who are the best kids, and then you have a fair game.
That's right. We can figure it out, but then we want to have her realize, and we want to validate her that she also wants to be part of the class. Sometimes we ask her, "How do you feel when some girls pick on you, or when girls are upset at you that you don't play?" They go, "It's not fair. We lose because of them. They're not trying their hardest. They come late, and then they're upset that we don't let them play. We started the game already. I should start." Like, they have valid points to a lot of their behaviors.
Which goes back to the prevention piece, that the
Bingo.
Game...
Right,
if
you start like this.
If the game gets started before the Rebbe or the teacher comes then you're running into this problem. But if the Rebbe or teacher walks the students out and helps them choose the game and helps them divide the teams, you're going to avoid a lot of the bullying type behavior. And I do agree with you. The second grade, first grade, we tend to see bullying peaking in middle school. And so
medical school is like we're talking about
6th, 7th, 8th grade. Those are the grade, and it actually gets less into high school. But the younger years, that's really where that social education and teaching those social skills and perspective taking, those are the opportunities to do that in the younger grades. So that by the time they get to the middle school, where it's kind of a nishta hin nishta her age, that then we can reduce the actual bullying as well.
Okay, here is a follow-up question, and it's a good one. I'm wondering if recess will be more difficult for some students if it's so structured. I know my students enjoy their free time. Question part A. Here's part B. This is even harder. In addition, with girls, recess is mostly centered around talking, not games. So how do you make that an inclusive activity?
I'll address the first part, and the inclusiveness and the structure is, and you may disagree because you said something earlier.
Please disagree
that
all the time.
But I don't think you force kids to do an activity that they don't want to do. Well, you actually said you restructured it in the camp to find activity. There are some kids that their way of processing the day and recess is walking on the outskirts of the playground, kicking pebbles, and just the introverts and the non-athletes. It's only when they're not being included in the game and they want to be part of the game. That's really where you start having the issue. But there are some times where a child just needs that time alone, you know, to
be alone.
To decompress, So there are some, so it's not, I don't think the implication was that everyone must play the same game
but
at the same time.
But you have to just make sure that whoever wants to play is going to play.
Correct.
But they don't have it. And what do you say about the girls, that most of it is centered around talking and not games?
You know, it's hard to know. The age, you know, plays into that as well.
Right.
You know, the teacher has an opportunity to facilitate conversations as well. So the same way that, you know, a teacher might walk them out to the playground and they're playing ball or something, the same way a teacher can participate and interject and listen to the conversations and try to make that an inclusive environment as well.
Okay.
I first agree 100% with what you shared about the first point, and that is that different kids have different natures. About what teachers can do with girls is, it's very true that the girls are, let's say they're talking, but it's about the group. There's usually going to have, again, in the class you'll have a lot of verbal girls, you know, that are more outspoken than others, but it's really about having the groups, like the teachers. Just feel it out. What's going on?
Right.
Did they have three girls doing it? Many times you're not interested in that conversation. I mean, how many times do you have a shul, and after shul there's a couple people will get together? These people like talking about one topic. These people like talking about other topics. We're not forcing 20 girls all talking at the same conversation.
Right.
We're talking about including. There's usually going to have the three or four people that lead everything, and the rest of the 16 girls are trying to follow. So maybe four or five are happy. They have little stuff, but there's still 12, 13 girls that the teacher can help them. So get in touch with them. What's going on? What are you doing by lunch? What are you talking? You don't have, let's get you girls together. Give them some exercises to do, something to talk about, a conversation. There's a lot that a teacher can facilitate.
Right.
I recently had an interaction with a student. He's a socially awkward kind of kid. And you know, I was trying to find his what his interests were. And so I said, what really interests you? This was a sixth grader, and he says, I'm really interested in highways. And then I knew I was in trouble. What sixth graders want to talk about highways? But this kid was interested in highways.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, I hope I didn't offend anyone that's interested in highways. I happen to like maps, but you know, as a sixth grader, you know, kids are talking about football and kids are talking about baseball, and he's talking about highways. He's probably not going to formulate this connection. And I asked him if he felt that he was missing out on, you know, did he find common ground with other kids? Because he recognized that highways was unique. And he didn't have an issue with it. And I get this from parents a lot. We really value socialization and connectivity, but not all kids need that. Some kids are introverted, and they really like to be within themselves. And just because someone is not included or not engaged doesn't mean that it's necessarily a problem for that child. If the child's happy, the child's reporting that he does connect to friends, in whatever way he connects and he's satisfied with that, if they have odd interests and that is not something that, you know, they might connect and communicate about, that's okay as well.
As you were speaking, I just had an idea. What would happen if a teacher would sort of do the similar prevention and intervention that I've mentioned, let's say that Rebbe speaks to each kid, and at the beginning, just speak to the girls, like you right away get to see how the class gets divided in a certain way, and then speak to the other girls and say, what do you like? Which girls do you want to be your friend? You know, when you go to camp, they have you choose, pick three girls that you want, and everyone picks. And usually you pick people that are similar to your natures, like you won't, like, or similar to who you like. And many times the teacher will see, hey, there are four girls that want to be friends with each other, but they just need someone to get it connected.
Right.
And then the teacher can do that. They might not want to be with these in that group. So again, it's about the teacher speaking to the students that aren't in the group or the girl that's just left out.
And putting a team together like that.
And I really think that a theme that my own observation that keeps emerging is the role of the teacher as a unifier in so many ways. But it has to be something, for teachers, it has to be something that is on an agenda. Because if you just sort of let it play out, it doesn't get addressed. Because going back, teachers are under pressure to get through the curriculum, to teach the material, to get the kriya skills up to a certain point, and to get the so many psukim by the end of the month, and it becomes hard and if it's not really on the priority list and on the to-do list, it's not going to get done. But really, that's really one of the primary roles of a teacher.
So
when we think about our educational experiences, and this goes back to what you were saying before, all right, we got some chumash skills, we got some mishnah skills. But what do we remember? We remember the Rabbeim and the teachers that we had an emotional connection to. And we remember the peers, the relationships we had, the friends that we had that treat us well and that didn't treat us well. You know, you open telling the story of that letter that the boy wrote.
Right.
The question is, if someone had given his peers the skills of supporting the victim, what would that have done for him back then? Maybe he still helped, but if he had that support, all it took was one person to support him later on in life that made the difference. But what if his peers in sixth grade, someone said, you know what, I'm here for you, whatever you need. You know, I think that changes the trajectory and the role of the teachers and the social workers in promoting that sort of environment, promoting that sort of interaction, pro-social behaviors between kids. That makes the difference.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of different things, and there are a lot more things to cover. And I want to tell you one of the things, when I was studying these questions before, I saw that a lot of teachers were really asking about what happens if a parent asks me this question, and what do I do if a parent asks me this question, or even somebody, a teacher who wrote this, and I'm just going to read you this question. Hi, I am a teacher listening, but this is painful for me personally because I, as a parent of a 10-year-old, was approached by him just yesterday, in bold, yesterday. He said, Ma, you want to hear something nasty? A kid in my class told me I can't play because I play really bad. Then he turned his face away and cried. How can I empower him? How should I have responded? So here's what I want to say. What I want to say is that what we should all do, or actually the two of you should do, and I should just like ask you the questions, we should do something for parents, right?
Now we got the teacher's role, although believe me, there are so many questions that we didn't answer. But there's so much wisdom that came from the two of you. It's like, mamish, amazing. Like, I'm just thinking that if teachers take this, like, this whole program and they really run with it, they're going to really, really change their classroom. There's nothing to talk about. I just want to go back to one thing. You know how you were saying that on the first day of school, that a teacher should say, okay, this is your rule for homework, and this is a rule for this, and this is what, and then here's how we treat each other? I would just flip that around. I would say, if I was a teacher, this is what I would do on the first day. I would say, the first thing we're talking about is, we're not going to talk about what you're going to learn this year. We're not going to talk about the homework rules. We're not going to talk about your attendance and not attendance. We're going to talk about one thing in this class. This is the first words coming out of the teacher's mouth. We're going to talk about how we're all going to treat each other and go through that on the very first day. Even spend the entire day on it. That is going to really register that this is really important because this is the first thing they spoke about. Anyway, okay. Okay, so I just wanted to just finish by just mentioning a few things. And that is the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation has, this is our teacher's catalog, and in this teacher's catalog are many, many, many curriculums and tools and videos. A lot of them are actually anti-bullying. We have something called Tiki, which is teaches, intervention for kids and advice for kids, and we have something called Kamoicha. We have a lot of amazing programs that are anti-bullying and that teach Midos, and that we've gotten fantastic feedback from teachers. So we are going to go to closing remarks, and we're going to start with Dr. Shapiro. If you'd like to just sum it up, I know it's hard to sum up everything we spoke about or whatever, but.
So first of all, the amazing work that the Chofetz Chaim Heritage Foundation is doing, just really it's great to be part of this. And I think the one takeaway that I would hope for teachers is really, it's a paradigm shift that the role of the teacher, and I think we know this and we say it, but it really has to actualize in our classrooms. The role of the teacher goes beyond the curriculum, it goes beyond the classroom management, it goes beyond the lesson planning to the social emotional needs of students across the board. And we were talking a lot about bullying tonight, and there's a whole host of social emotional challenges that kids are facing, but if we can really create an environment within the classroom that is accepting and understanding and empathetic and perspective taking, all these pieces that we talked about tonight, then not only is it going to be an environment where kids are going to thrive emotionally, they're going to thrive academically as well.
Yeah.
And really all goes together.
Right.
And the role of the teacher is really just seeing that and being planning and being aware of that role in your classroom.
Wow, beautiful, beautiful. Okay, great, great. Mordechai.
I first want to thank you for inviting me, Rabbi Rothschild. It's an honor and a schus to be here a second time. I am honored, Dr. Shapiro, also being with you, and the way you're able to reframe or rephrase the things that I said sounding so well and so professional, that's a pleasure. I'd like to thank the principals, teachers, and Rebbeim for being interested and for sending in the messages. I would probably assume at least 200 messages or 300 messages in that area, so you're really engaged, asking the right questions, and Mikamcha Yisrael, that we have that. I'm touched by that. My closing remark would be realizing the power that we have as teachers and Rebbeim, that one little shift can make that change. I would like to share with you just a little concept that I like. The concept is called the imposter theory. It was discovered, let's see, in 1978, and I love it. The imposter theory was they were interviewing professionals, doctors, lawyers, judges, and they asked them, like, how do you feel being the doctor, that lawyer, that judge? And they go, don't tell anyone, but I feel I'm a fraud. And that's why they use this concept of imposter theory. And after years later, many felt they grew into their role and made them feel, I'm really a terrible accountant. If you would only know, I don't know why people are coming. So the imposter theory is we can be leaders on the outside, but inside we feel terrible. Many victims of bullying, like we said, or the bully, in second grade, they get labeled and pigeonholed with that certain role. And if we can recognize that years later, we're still stuck with that. We, the teachers, the Rebbeim, the principals, and social workers, we can change that by just interacting a little with the kids. And my final remark is, they say about the Chafetz Chaim that his midos were so amazing that it almost like outshone like his the learning that he had, the Mishnah Berurahs around everything. Who doesn't have a Mishnah Berurah in their house?
Right.
I could now understand why you, Rabbi Rothschild, was able to help that Shmir's Halashen should be global all over. Your midos, your care, okay, that you couldn't even do the role this play of attacking, is like, I really got it. And with the picture okay of the Chavetz Chaim right behind you, I just thank Hashem, and I can see why it happened.
Okay, we'll debate that a different time, but I want to thank both of you, because I have learned so much, and I'm just blown away, because if teachers take what the two of you said, it's a complete game changer, and they're changing somebody's life, like, for their entire life. Like, everything is going to be different. And so I'm hoping that you know, there's 240 schools that are participating, and I'm hoping, Emir Tzashem, that thousands of kids maybe are going to have, you know, that the teachers are going to take it. Any teacher, principal, or social worker that would like to take this program, please, you know, email us. And the email address for any questions about curriculum is S. Orenstein. Did they put this on the screen? It's S. Orenstein, SORNSTEIN, at cchfglobal.org. And he is our school liaison, and he can answer any questions and bring any programs to you. And the catalog is on. If you go right now to cchf.global, you could see actually the whole catalog. Or you could call us at 845-352-3505, and we will send you actually a physical catalog, which is really gorgeous and has all these curriculum in it. So I just want to finish with a story. There was in the Midwest, this happened in a school. There was two brothers, a fourth grader and a fifth grader, and the fifth grader told the fourth grader, you know, it's not fair that you learn this Chafetz Chaim program, because I see the way you boys play so nicely at recess, and we fight all the time, and we have such a terrible recess. Amazing, no? So thank you all very much for coming and for your questions. And I just want to finish with a bracha, that you who have chosen to raise Hashem's children and to inspire them with Hashem's Torah, Hashem should first of all send you tremendous Siyata Dishmaya with your own children, that you should have tremendous nachas and things should go easy, and you should have easy shidduchim and enough money to pay for everything that you need, and that you should realize how exalted and powerful and loved you are by Hashem, that your teaching is Torah, and this is more important to him than anything else, and you should be gebenched and just have tremendous siyata d'shmaya, and thank you so much for joining us.
Nobody likes to be left out of games. A joke is not a joke when someone else gets hurt.
Bullying. Turning school into a place of despair rather than friendship and growth.
I think that Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation deserves so much credit for the Tiki program. I just have no words to describe the beauty of it and how the children, both in the boys' school and the girls' school, gained tremendously.
When Tiki came to our class, he taught us not to bully by recess.
Tiki taught us that mean words last a very long time.
Tiki taught us how to stop, think, and feel, and taught us not to ignore a bully situation.
When Tiki came to our class, he taught us that everybody should be included in every game.
Now our class includes everybody in the game.
And now I get to play.
Whenever there's a bullying situation, we say that we don't do this here.
Tiki taught us not to make a joke if it's going to hurt somebody's feelings.
When we had Tiki in our class, it brought more actors together.